So this is board time Wednesday, January 8th.
Struggling and the leadership making appointments without using the process. All right, we're all here.
Are we ready to go?
Yep.
Yeah.
Okay, new board chair, Commissioner Mielke.
Woohoo!
So,
hi, everybody.
Okay, first item on the agenda is Dolly building rents.
Yeah.
More specifically, I'd just like to have a philosophical discussion regarding nonprofits.
Yeah.
And first, a little background. When the recession hit, Commissioner Stewart suggested that we create a nonprofit incubation program using the Dolly Building as leverage. And his idea was that we offer fledgling nonprofits low rent in the Dolly Building as a way to improve their financial situation so that they could actually get off the ground and become successful nonprofits.
Well, and also because they were empty at the time.
Plus
the Dolly Building
yes,
was
correct.
We had a lot of vacancies within it, so it was like, well, we could get nothing,
or do some good.
Or do some good, exactly, and work that we couldn't do because we had limited resources. Yeah. So, you know, it was a... Anyway.
Right, and we've had a variety of nonprofits take advantage of that. We've had Dream Big, and apparently they...
They're moving on.
Yeah. So that's a success story because when they moved in, I do believe they qualified as a fledgling nonprofit. But over time, we've had longstanding nonprofits come to us asking for low rents in the building. And so I just wanted to circle the wagons with the commission here and make sure that that we're doing your bidding as it relates to that building and nonprofit. So in that regard, I've got a little bit of info. Every month, we receive a report from Terry Phillips, who is the contractor that does our property management down there. He's responsible for marketing the building, for tenant relations, and to the extent that incoming tenants want tenant improvements, then he comes to us and we talk to facilities about making the improvements they need and that sort of thing. And it's been a pretty good relationship. He gets a flat $850 a month as a retainer fee, and then he gets a percentage of...
That's pretty substantial.
And he also gets a percentage if he brings in new lessees. He gets a percentage of the lease value, which I believe is standard practice in the industry. So, as you can see on the front here, it tells us which suites are vacant, and I have a little floor plan for the building that lays out where the vacancies are. The second floor has no vacancies because that space is the premium space. It's up off the ground. You have nicer views out the windows. And I'm sorry, the printer was set up to duplex, so we've got an upside-down image on page two. First floor, we have two large suites, 115 and 120, a total of 5,000 square feet that are vacant.
So this is the first floor.
This is the first floor. Yeah, and the lower right is where it says first floor. Now, Terry says that large suites are hard to fill. Small spaces are easier to fill. He said it's the nature of the market currently. And then when you go down into the basement, which is the least desirable space in the building because the windows, the lighting, it's more of a dungeon down there, and so it's not surprising that we have four vacant suites.
So that's what we call it, the lower level?
That's the lower level.
Isn't that where the Board of Equalization is? Been there forever?
Yes.
Oh, yeah. Oh, that building.
So, and you can see that the spaces are chopped up into smaller chunks. And I think that was done to facilitate leasing the dungeon space to other folks. Now, it just so happens that as we marketed our nonprofit, we tried to put the nonprofit folks in the space on the lower level. And so you can see in Suite 50 there in the upper left, the NWABA, that's the Northwest Association of Blind Athletes.
Mm-hmm.
They've been in the building for a number of years. And then... Sunrise O'Mahony and the Watershed, Vancouver Watershed Council is in Suite 45. So we have two nonprofits. Dream Big is still in there, but their lease has expired, and we're just doing an extension on a week-to-week, month-to-month until
just
they move out.
Stuff.
Pardon?
Yeah, they're just moving their stuff. It's taking a little
time. Yeah, so I've highlighted them as a vacant space.
Which one?
Dream big. 18.
Number 18.
18. This one right here. Okay. So I marked it as vacant, even though technically Dream Big is physically in
when
the space.
When are they going to move out?
Oh, in the next couple weeks. Okay. So I think it's just a logistical issue with them. So I guess the question is, we do have six vacant suites, and if you look at the total square footage, it's like 7,000 square feet. So staff is looking for guidance. We have two interested parties now. We have the Latino group, Commissioner Stewart, that contacted you, and we're going to get them in and show them what we have. And then we have FETV, and Mr. John Barber has been talking to Commissioner Medora about moving in there. And
the potential if we were looking at youth house activity.
Well, that's what I'm looking at, the larger square footage.
Yeah, the larger suites would work better for that.
Yeah, and it's also desired first floor.
Yeah, so they would have plenty of windows, and it would be decent space for them.
And those are harder to fill anyway, so that might be a good call.
So also, I don't know if they talked to you, Veteran Relief Council Chairman was...
Yeah, Morris Geisler's looking for space for himself.
Yeah, and I didn't know, some of these are pretty small, I didn't know if that would work.
It's just an office he's looking for, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yep. So I'll get. I think I have a meeting scheduled with Morris here real soon. So that's one of the things we'll talk about.
I think you have a closet over here on down the basement.
You can put it next to me.
16 square feet. Is that what that was?
It must be. Jeez.
No, we've actually had somebody in there previously. So the question is, since we have vacant space and since we have nonprofits that can still benefit from reduced rents, shall we continue with the reduced rent program for nonprofits in the building until the economy improves and we can improve occupancy with full rent-paying tenants?
More recently, this thing has come up, gifts of public funds. Mm-hmm. Does this fall in that category?
No.
We had legal look at it early on.
Yeah, we vetted it with Chris Horn.
Yeah. And they were specifically saying if they're doing work that benefits the community that is in the same vein or a similar vein to what we as a county do, then it's not considered a gift of public funds to give reduced rent.
Okay. I think when we started off, it was kind of a hit and miss thing. It wasn't even meant to be permanent, but in some cases it has been. It's not as if we have a lack of space.
We don't have a waiting list either. They're beating our doors down to get in.
I'm not having a problem with it.
Okay.
Certainly the initial launch of the reduced rent for nonprofits sounded like a timely good thing, especially if it was at the time it was vacant. One possibility here is to, now that they've been here for some time and you've got already an agreement that looks like it's like, what, 6 months or a year at a time, that you could potentially say, well, we'd be happy to keep you as a tenant, but rather than have the reduced rent the same as it was before, here we want you to be able to pay the normal rent that any other tenant would pay. That's one possibility.
Right.
Start ramping it up a little bit over time.
Which is what we've done.
Kind of start slowly pushing them out towards self-sufficiency, that kind of thing.
Whether that's a step or whether that's a ramp.
However
you want to say it.
The question is,
what would be appropriate there? Does the fella, what's his name? Terry, what does he feel like if we had vacancies that he could fill them and walk away?
Terry actively markets the building. He actually he uses the internet and every method he knows to employ. But there is a glut of space. The market hasn't recovered, and it may be another 3 to 5 years before we can fill this building up with full rental tenants.
I see that there's a lot of other spaces. Are they already filled with full?
If they're not highlighted, they're filled with full rent paying tenants. And the full list of tenants is in this report right here on the back page. So we have Vancouver Defenders, Northwest Justice, Art Miller, Robin Crane, Competitive Edge, a number of Vancouver Defenders rents quite a bit of space from us. They're indigent defense attorneys. Mm-hmm. We have a children's center in there. Greco Downs, Clark County Bar Association. So if it's highlighted, in yellow, it's a nonprofit. If it's highlighted in the orange, it's vacant. Every other suite is occupied with a full rent-paying tenant.
What do you suggest in like for after 1 year, pick up 25% or 50%?
I would think at this point, just some preliminary conversation would be to learn a little bit more about the health of these two organizations and the source of funding that they're getting, to just to consider more input to us
Well, I'm looking for programmatic guidance. I would really prefer not to bring each suite's lease to the commission, asking for guidance on each one.
Well, and it was originally set up as an incubator to give them a chance to get on their feet so that they could get their own space. And part of the, and we had talked about it early on, is that they would have a plan for how are you going to move on? You know, what's your plan for how you're going to use this as a springboard to actually move on out, and get your own space. And so, we've probably been a little bit lax in that. But that may give some of the information that you're looking for, is like how is it that you think that you'll kind of make that next step?
Did they present a plan back when they were first?
A couple of them did, but
there's only two that we're looking at here, right?
Yeah, I know that.
Yeah, we've had them come and go. I think Dream Big actually is moving out because we did escalate the rent a little bit. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But still, we're only looking at two nonprofits.
Two existing.
The question is, did those nonprofits present a plan?
I haven't seen one.
If so, do we have a copy of it?
I haven't seen.
Okay. So I would think the next step would be to have a conversation with them and say.
Right. But what I'm asking about is not these two necessarily, or the two that we're considering. And programmatically, yes, they should present a plan, and I'll see if they have a plan on file.
Because they've been in there for a year, so the idea of incubating should have been incubated past tense by now. Right?
Well, in Nuwaba, they've been in there two, three years, something like that.
Yeah,
I think they exist about the other one. Off donations. I know Northwest Blind Athletes do.
Yeah,
they're solely contribution athletes to support the function of blind athletes. Mm-hmm. I know that they've done better and better each year, and they've grown and they've become more nationally recognized as a national organization.
Mm-hmm. And we've been reluctant to be super aggressive because we do have plenty of vacant space. And
is that the oranges are vacant?
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, the thing that precipitated this conversation is the possibility of using some of this vacant space for FBTV. And I plan to see that tomorrow.
Right.
But what may be the chosen offer on that for FBTV, get it, is that the building's only available Monday through Friday during working hours.
And that is the issue. That'll be the issue with the youth house, too. Like some of the stuff that they do, that's going to be the issue. Yeah.
And if that be the case, that may be just unless we could fix that, that probably won't work because there's volunteers that come in and there's different hours. That probably won't work. I noticed that I did look at the rental agreement for the two nonprofits that are there, and I see that we're also providing twice a week janitor service, and we're only collecting $300 per month from these two spaces. I wonder how profitable, just the profit and loss statement of the whole building. How are we doing?
That's what this report is.
Look at the report.
I'd suggest we peruse this later.
I think that we'd go back and say they even paid 50% after 1 year. It'd tell you whether or not they were a successful nonprofit organization or just an organization.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so if they need all that space that they have, do they just need a little office, or do they need 1,000 square feet?
Well, see, they could decide that if they're paying 50% of the rent.
So owner contribution. Let's see.
So the bottom line
owner distribution. That building earned us $270,000 after all expenses paid.
That includes. Is there any debt on that building?
No. So that money goes to Bob Stevens. He uses it to pay debt service on this building and the campus expansion we did.
Okay, well that's over
12 months.
12 months. Okay.
So I think that building cost us $2 million, so that's a 10% return on our investment.
A long time ago. Mm-hmm. Over our time.
Yes.
I'm okay. For me, I'm okay with continuing, but I do think for anybody that was looking to get in there, or anybody who is in there, that having a plan for, you know, how is it that they're going to be successful in incubating, because at some point the economy is going to come back, you know, and when it comes back, you know, I'd hate to just say, oh, by the way, now you're all out, and they had no plan, you know. It's like, this is our opportunity to kind of help them make sure that they're thinking about what is our future and how are we going to get there.
It sounds good. What I'd like people to do is to learn a little bit more about them. For instance, at US Digital, what we do is we periodically will sit down with each of the nonprofits and ask them, how often are you using your space? And how's that space, is it the right size for you? And make sure that we close the loop, and how and those basic questions ought to be answered for these guys, because maybe it's just one guy in one office and a much smaller space would be sufficient, or maybe they're not using it, you know, but once or twice a week for a couple hours. So it really would be a good, how good a stewardship are we of this space? And so I would think before we try to set any policy or direction, we would learn the status of these two organizations.
Well, he's got a couple of new ones I think he's looking for guidance on, is why he's looking.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I'm
guidance.
Looking for programmatic, not. I mean, I can get you whatever you like on these two, mm-hmm. but going forward, we have two queued up. We have the, mm-hmm. I can't recall the name, it's a Latino group of some sort.
Business group.
And then we have FETV. So FETV is not an incubating program, although it is in financial difficulty. So, and the money that we give them to operate, if they're just going to turn around and give it back to us in rent, it's circular money. So we could actually let them occupy space in there for no rent and then deduct that from what we pay them, because, you know, we're a contributor to their budget. Mm-hmm. But for this Latino group, you know, have they been in business for 15 years? Are they an ongoing successful nonprofit? Yeah. If they are, then I wouldn't want to charge them $4 a square foot. I might want to charge them $7 instead of $14.
It's new. It's... I'm forgetting the name of it.
We still have LULAC.
Yeah, and so LULAC is the overarching umbrella, kind of the Latino advocacy group. This is a Latino Business Owners Association that's been formed by Latino business owners and is establishing as a nonprofit to advocate and work with local business owners to help them expand their businesses and to get connected with resources.
They're
and all
moving
that.
Down the chamber.
Yeah, exactly.
And both of these, as I understand it, this is the only space either of these two nonprofits have, and it's their full-time base of operation. So, and it's only 1,000 square feet, so it's not they aren't spacious suites. So I will get their financials to see how they're doing financially, see if they have an improvement plan.
I'm not sure if we want to get involved in running their business, or whether either we allow them to be there or we don't.
Well, I think what Commissioner Mador was asking as far as, is the space working? Functional questions are questions that you would ask, you know, you'd ask almost any tenant, you know, business tenant, is the space working for you, and what are you, you know, what are your needs and that kind of thing.
Who oversees that building? Do we have an individual?
Yeah, Laura Peterson in General Services has a responsibility. Okay. She works with Terry Phillips, who is our property management consultant. Mm-hmm. He handles the property.
We've had moves, like I know for Dream Big. Dream Big was on the second floor?
Second floor.
And then moved down to the basement because they did a space analysis. They said, well, you know, do you really need this suite on the second floor? You know, would another size suite in a different area fit? And oh, by the way, we have a potential tenant, full-paying tenant.
Vancouver Defenders wanted that space.
Right.
They were going to pay us $14 or so.
They got moved. So Dream Big
moved
down.
So we moved them down to the basement.
So there's some of it's going on, but I don't know if it's as systematic as what you're talking about.
I think we should have at least one conversation with them and then mm-hmm. find out where they're at. Mm-hmm. When it comes to the incubation of nonprofit organizations, it's a really good thing. The question is, who should do that? Mm-hmm. And there are businesses within the county and other nonprofits within the county that have stepped up to the plate and would likely welcome that kind of an arrangement. We're one of them. As for should the county be in that role, probably not. I would think because these are public funds and the the county being a source of being a landlord, that is a different role. So it's really a question of what organization has the appropriate role. Are we the incubator of nonprofits? It's a really good cause, but are we the right organization? I would think it'd be a better solution would be for businesses and other nonprofits to be able to learn of the opportunities, and then maybe they could provide the home for these organizations. We could find that out.
So we got nobody in those spaces right now. So it's either make zero money or make some money is the way that I look at it. And then secondly, these are nonprofit organizations that are specifically doing work of benefit to the community that we represent in areas that we don't have the resources to do ourselves. It's through partnerships. I mean, a lot of the work that we get done here, I mean, it may not be the role of us directly to do it, because we don't have the resource to do it. But if we had unlimited resources, would the county be in the position of, you know, actually working with young people in the community to help keep them out of crime? Yeah, but we don't have unlimited resources, so we rely on partners to do that. So the question is simply, how can we facilitate those partners is the way I look at it. And so, and then just from the strict finances of it, yeah, we're getting this much or a little bit, and I'll take a little bit over nothing as a business proposition any day.
Those are good points. I would think that if we are, in whatever capacity, the landlord for some of nonprofits, mm-hmm. that those nonprofits, that our scope would be Clark County.
Yeah,
and we wouldn't necessarily be the home of a national organization.
Totally
or something
agree.
Like that.
Yeah, totally agree.
Well, but national organizations have local chapters.
But it's the scope of the efforts, Clark County. And that's
what we actually have, really. So
it is, but I mean, as far as a policy, yeah, that makes great. Yeah. I mean, I agree totally.
I think it's a good point. Find out if it's working out for them. I want to be helping along the way. I don't want to be subsidizing with janitorial services.
Yeah, I agree with that.
The rent is free.
Yeah.
No, it's not. We charge them rent.
Yeah, but you know, but
as far as it's a reduced rent.
But is that even paying the janitorial? And I mean,
yeah,
you know.
Well, they get electricity and water and restrooms. And
right. Exactly. So
and all that. So.
So maybe janitorial.
So maybe after an incubation period, that the rent probably should go 50%.
You start moving them along. Yeah. That has been the idea, at least.
So. I think it's been good. We've utilized vacant space to the a benefit of our community. Like I said, it'd be different if there was a shortage of places or other places available, and we were competing with the private sector, and I don't think we are here.
Yeah. I am curious if we have that many vacancies, how well we are marketing it, if the other commercial brokers are tuned in. It seems $850 a month for the person to do this and still have that much vacancy. I would question that. We own a building off of 112th Avenue, and we're paying $500 a month, and he does everything. And he's got a 10-year lease tenant in there. It doesn't cost us anything. It's just
single
tenant?
Everything.
Of course, he's single as a...
Well, and you look at how many suites we have.
This is the most desirable. We do have...
And the building, unfortunately, is the most desirable.
Now, we've repainted, we put new carpet in, we remodeled the bathrooms, we've made it, we're putting lipstick on a pig is what we're doing.
It's still, as far as downtown space, there's a lot nicer, newer space downtown than Dolly Building.
That will not let nonprofits in, like we're discussing.
Well, why don't we come back in a week or two after we get more input, especially I'm curious to see it, because I'm thinking for the FETV, I have my great doubts that it's going to work if you're limited to working hours.
Yeah.
And I'm curious, is it that working hours limitation, is that mainly because none of these doors lock, or that's the question?
We had a tenant in there that we gave a slight rent reduction to assume responsibility for security of the building. No existing tenant wants to take responsibility for that. And so... we want to make sure that the building is secure until until hours of operation and secure at the end,
so
of,
it's
the,
our deal,
end of the business day.
Pardon me? So it's our deal as far as the why we have those?
Now, if an employee is in the building at 6 and walks out of the building and ensures that the door's latched behind them, no big deal. But we don't want patrons coming in after 5 o'clock or coming in before 8.
So anyway, I'm very curious. Okay. I'll be looking at this physically tomorrow, and I'd like to learn more about this, and then we have another conversation.
Sure.
Good. Invoice review.
Okay, I've got a number of invoices here. You know, at the beginning of a new year, folks who receive money from the county for various things send out invoices so that they can secure those monies. We have another, recall the Woodland Chamber and Visitor Center. We were invoiced for $5,000. I think we agreed to pay them $25,000.
Yep, for the Visitor Center.
For the Visitor Center. We have another $5,000 invoice, and just want to confirm that $2,500 again for 2014 is okay.
Okay. Not very much when you compare it with what our tourism we invest in the city of Vancouver.
This is when we already looked at the
city of Woodland, and just to remind the board that the reason that you approved $2,500 was because we have a visitor center that is a gateway to the Gifford Pinchot and the Mount St. Helens area, and we have people that come and stay in hotels and then drive up there.
Several years. So.
And so,
but specifically that aspect of it.
Yeah.
The Vancouver Tourism Board, all these hotels, or not all of them that are enrolled, pay a tax themselves so that they can benefit and bring tourism. And I wonder, what is our local Vancouver Business Bureau doing for this visitor center?
We already asked them if they would give money.
Nothing.
The answer is
not doing anything.
Nothing.
Well, that, but I
no, they, that tax I think they pay to the State Tourism Bureau or what have you.
They pay it to us.
Pardon?
They pay it to the local jurisdiction.
It's the local jurisdiction.
Oh, do they?
Yeah, I sit on that board. We make the local decisions of where we're going to spend that money.
Oh, right.
But this is outside county boundaries, isn't it?
I believe that.
It's actually right on the
border. Part of Woodland
is in the county.
Yeah.
It depends on which part.
Well,
but the visitor center is just outside.
So I would think before we just give them a green light and just keep doing this, that we would talk to, make sure we communicate with the Vancouver Tourism Board and get insight from them. Why aren't you supporting this? We should at least be partnering with
I
them.
I think that we've already been there, so I would rather than hold up their plan and their budget that we go forward with this and then look for next year or ongoing, because we haven't asked them before. And they said, no, we already have plans for our dollars.
Since September 11th, since I started attending these meetings, we've been through this. And
Yeah, Kelly, you called, didn't you? The executive committee for the Convention and Visitors Bureau met and declined to provide funding to the Woodland Visitors.
And I understand the yes, no. They must have some reasoning behind that.
The reason basically had to do with the fact that the tourism promotion area, which is the primary funding for the Convention and Visitors Bureau, is generated by hotels in the urbanized area of Clark County in the city of Vancouver. And even though there may be some ancillary benefit that accrues to them from visitors to Mount St. Helens and whatnot, the generation of the revenue is strictly within the urban growth area of Clark County, and so that's where they're concentrating their expenditures.
Okay. What I would suggest is, well, first of all, it's a little behind the ball at this point if you already got an invoice here and we're determining. So I would think that whatever you want to do toward this, if you want to do the 2,900, that's okay.
I would like to do it this year, and then it gives us a year to work with local tourism to see if they want to spread out.
So I'll make it one of my action items to learn more about this particular investment and to get insight from the tourism board. Go ahead. And we'll pay the $2,500 for this, but so that next time we'll already have done the homework.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think you
can I get a copy of this?
You sit on the tourism thing and get work with.
Yeah, that's kind of my role.
Okay.
Go to lunch up there at the Woodland Chamber. It's pretty fun.
They do have some pretty lively lunches there. Do they still have the oak tree? I haven't been to one for a while.
Well, the oak tree, I think, is closed.
No, it's open.
It's open again.
It's open again. Okay. And they still have bankruptcy stew.
Yeah. That's the best stuff.
They have a large chamber for how small Woodland is.
They really do.
Interesting.
huge,
an active chamber. Yeah, exactly.
Huge.
Darlene Johnson. Okay, so okay for 20. Okay for 25, and you're going to do
for
some
the,
legwork.
Yes,
for the follow up with our local tourism.
Yeah, I think so.
Okay, next is annual. The once a quarter contribution to CVTV for 108,961.
That passed $1, isn't it?
CVTV?
Yeah. More or less. Yeah.
More or less. It's a
is
franchise.
This money that
it's budgeted.
That's the franchise money that we just passed through.
Yep.
Okay.
And then we get services from them as part of that, including all of our meetings and everything else that we don't pay the specific for, whereas other organizations have to pay to have CVTV show up.
How much is Vancouver City paying?
About the same.
I think they've been.
I'd like to verify. Right. Can you verify and see how much they're paying? I'd like to be able to know.
We have it one time. It's been
so
a while.
So this is a year.
We could do it. Yeah.
It's once a quarter.
Once a quarter.
A quarter. $400,000 a year.
Yeah, they probably have a
million plus budget.
A million plus budget between the city and the county.
And if you look at the staff and the equipment that supports the county weekly at their hearings and all that.
When it comes to the money coming in, are we receiving? Who's getting the money from Comcast?
We do. The franchise, just to clarify that, the 5% franchise fee, it goes into the general funds. There's no direct nexus with paying CBTV or FBTV or anyone else. And that money goes directly to the county. And the City of Vancouver franchise fee goes directly to the City of Vancouver. It's just general fund money, just like a property.
So how much money is going into our general fund from that?
More than that, yeah.
About, I think we'll probably give them a half.
Okay.
We probably fund...
Can
probably
find
give
I'll find out the revenue amount too.
Okay.
Good.
So this is for the this coming quarter.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Yep. So every 3 months.
And is this the same?
Now I'd like approval to pay every quarterly invoice for the coming year, as opposed to bringing an invoice to the board once a quarter.
Is that the same amount that it's been for the last several years?
I don't know.
Can we find that out?
We lowered it when we started giving FBTV money. We lowered it
to $50,000.
Yeah. We took like $50,000 out of it, and I don't remember if it's been changed up or down. Other than that, that's the only time I remember us lowering it.
Being that FBTV is in flux right now, mm-hmm. or at least we're in the opportunity point where we could take it from the 1.0 where it's at, which is absolutely failing. To a 2.0, which you would need a full-time general manager there. You would need at least a part-time technical person there. They don't have either right now. And they would need a space to be their new home, and they would really need to have more expertise on the board. So all that's in opportunity right now. We don't know if that'll happen. But I would, if we took something from CVTV for FBTV in the past, that's all up in the air right now. So I would say before we just simply blanket for the year, that I'll add this to my list to make sure that I'm informed on both CBTV and FBTV and what mix goes where, and then let you know if there's something that I recommend any change on that. So we'll talk about it.
You're recommending the change what we give for Vancouver TV?
Well, I would say right now there's a contract that says the county will pay $50,000 per year in four quarterly increments to FBTV. And it is just enough to do damage. They haven't been able to do their accounting. They haven't been able to do their management. It's in a very, very sad state of affairs. And it would be really bad if we were just to continue that without making a correction. So we need to either bring it to the... make FBTV into what they can be and... somehow work with CBTV or whatever and be able to consider that ratio.
Yeah.
Or
and one of the things that's been brought up is that when the 50,000 got moved, we just absorbed it back into the general fund from CBTV originally. We didn't put that back. You know, we say we gave FBTV 50,000, but there's always this debated $50,000 out there. So I don't really know.
We took it out of the Comcast. CBTV was getting.
The bottom line is, like, you guys,
they were real excited.
If you want to go that route, you can decide to go that route. It'll come out of general fund, but it would be Comcast franchise fees for whatever you decide you want to do down the road. I don't think it will really impact. I mean, unless you specifically want it to impact CBT's contribution,
it really wouldn't need to, I guess is my point.
Yeah. So it's up to you. Got extra general fund laying around? Because I don't. So, yes, it would need to.
Well, 44 days, man.
Yeah. You're giving them hire a full-time employee.
Well, it's a matter of taking, right now we're already paying them $50,000 a year.
Yeah.
And it's really hardly enough for them to be able
to can't live on $50,000.
Even one person. So
is that their only revenue source?
Pretty much. The rest they might.
Yeah. It was all volunteer before. I mean, they didn't get any contribution before, and so it was done all by volunteers. And so this was the $50,000 was in order to hire one manager of all of the volunteers. It wasn't to create a for-profit venture or to create some sort of, like, you know, professional operation. It was to hire a manager for all of the volunteer producers that came in. So if the model has changed or somehow they can't, I mean, no offense, but I mean, I worked as a nonprofit director, and I guarantee that even with benefits, I didn't make close to $50,000. So I mean, it would be interesting to see how much more would be necessary to fulfill the model, you know, like to make it work. I don't know.
I'm sorting that out. Okay. And Dr. John Barber WSU. Is very interested to help bring new leadership and vision to that.
Well, he works for the university. He's got plenty of money. So
I recommend that we stay focused in the direction that we have been, but continue to investigate and see what we can do.
So one quarter at a time.
Yes,
one quarter at a time. Since we got the
you've got to be careful if you make changes along the way, because if you take money out of the franchise, dollars, that means it's going to come from CBTV.
Or the general.
And, well, they also get all the instruments and all the equipment from CBTV.
Actually, there's a problem there too.
We get it from PEG. Yeah,
PEG. Yeah.
Yeah, and they haven't been able to access the PEG because their accounting is messed up.
You're trying to close out the last one.
So there's problems to solve.
Yeah.
So at this point, I would say don't make a year-long commitment. Let's searching this out, and we're working with new leadership to solve this problem in one quarter at a time.
That's the FETV piece of it that you're working on.
Yes.
But the CVTV, so they budget for a year, right? I mean, like, generally any organization is going to have either an annual or biannual budget. When you said, you know, we have a contract with FETV for $50,000, well, we have a contract with CVTV for four times that amount. Mm-hmm. So I guess my request would be, for this year, that the commitment has been made to CVTV for the services that they provide us, which are outstanding, and there aren't, you know, we're not having issues with them. So to create issues by, you know, throwing their budget into upheaval by saying, well, maybe it'll change in the next quarter, we're not sure, to me wouldn't be prudent. You know, it is prudent what you're doing with FETV and figuring out, do we need to switch it up and do we need an additional investment in them? But for this year, my request would simply be, like, let's just give the go-ahead to pay the invoices for CVT because we already committed to it for this. But then let's look at it as part of our budget process for next year, and not just for FETV, but also for CVT.
What you say makes good sense, and you're right. We don't want to send the wrong signal that, hey, we could mess things up by we're debating big decisions here. I'm not really saying that. I'm saying that at this point, we don't have a copy of the contract. I haven't seen it. It'd be good to be able to know when does it expire, how long, what are the rates on there, what's the trend, how's this current invoice match up to what we expected in the past. It would be good for us to be able to understand that up front before we just say, yeah, whatever it is, just do it for the year. That must reflect it. So it's just a matter of being diligent to make sure that we understand that we're informed when we make our decisions, so without sending the wrong signals.
We're waiting for some information. You like to see the contract?
Yeah. In other words, I have two check marks here to do here. Yeah. One is the Woodland Chamber of Commerce. The other one is to gain insight and make sure that we understand before we just make a decision for the year.
We've got to give CVTV some base as to what to expect.
Yeah, and I'll be back next week.
Well, I guess and it's on this one, and it'll be on other ones as well, is that
for next
decisions didn't just start when you came here, right? I mean, decisions were made with information and full conversation and budget writing and hearings and then decisions. So I am I think it would be a mistake for us to try to say, well, why don't we get information before we make the decision to pay the invoice on what we've already been decided. It's already been decided, and it was decided with good information. Just because we can't remember it off the top of our head doesn't mean we did it in the dark. You know, we made these decisions based on information that we gathered. And so I'm nervous about, you know, about us saying, well, let's just say, well, for your purposes, why don't we just go ahead and redo every decision we've made on budgetary decisions, and you can just, you know, we'll just override whatever we did before. You see what I'm saying? I mean, I just want there to be some certainty for our partners, and internally and externally, that the decisions that have been made are going to be honored. And then we'll make new decisions, you know, when we have the next.
This year.
That's what I'm saying. That's my point.
This year.
Yeah.
And
I'm not talking about 5 years in the future kind of stuff.
Vancouver TV's had bumps and grinds for a long time.
Okay.
We were kind of letting them sort their own problems out until they got into a personnel issue.
Yeah.
Then it kind of come to light. But I would like to continue in the way we're going and put something together if there's any going to be any changes or adjustments that would be done next year.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and certainly I'm not wanting to go down that road that you just painted. That's not
Thank
at all.
You.
It's just that the reason that we asked the question in the first place, should we pay this $100,000, $109,000 bill now, is making some assumptions that, well, we always have, so we always should keep doing it.
Yeah.
Well,
it's because it was in the budget. It's not because we always have. It was part of the budget.
I'm not doubting the legitimacy of the past. I'm just saying that our decisions are only as good as the information is based on.
Right.
And it would be good to be able to say, and here's the contract, and here's the history, and take a look at the glance. Yep, we're on track.
And I think you're welcome to get that information, and you should get that information.
Yeah.
I'm saying that we made decisions based on the information already.
Yeah.
So I don't need to relive the decision that was made for this year, because we already made it for future decisions. Absolutely, we got to have you need to have the information that you didn't have already.
So
I agree with
you. I trust your judgment on these invoices, and what I'm doing is extra insight to get me up to speed.
Awesome.
To make sure that we're being good stewards of the public funds, and that there are contracts, and we know what the dates are, we know what the rates are, we know what the trends are, and yep, we're on target, and we just didn't get an invoice that just happened to be twice as much as it was, and we never looked at it. It's just doing due diligence as we go.
It was part of that list that we had. That was part of the chambers also, and all that list. And we went through the horse group, and we recognized the advantage of that.
So
this is part of that list.
Got it. So on these invoices, you have the history behind it, and so you go ahead and make the decisions on it. My only input on this is that I'm going to get up to speed on it and make sure that we're
good.
That's great.
Absolutely.
That we're being good stewards.
Excellent.
Another great advice.
Perfect.
So I'm good to pay every quarterly invoice unless Commissioner Brodeur comes back with
this year's.
And if something really comes up.
Yeah, if this year's,
yeah, great. Thank you.
Yeah, I do not have veto power unless Commissioner Brodeur comes back and say, hey, guess what we found, guys? Take a look at that.
Exactly.
And then you
bring
decide.
It back, then we'll do it.
All right. Well, this is really fun. This next one.
Are we getting our money's worth?
This entertainment.
Yeah,
free.
This next one was approved by the membership of WASAC at their annual conference in November 21, 2013. And who was our representative?
That's Tom.
Okay, so did you vote for our annual dues of $60,244? And can I pay the bill?
Yes, you can.
Thank you.
Okay. I have on my list.
Do you want to do any research on this one?
To look at the trend, how has that invoice amount changed over time, and have we even reviewed or approved the changes? I don't know. So I find out.
Is it based
that's
on population?
Do you want to make an
it is. Yeah. That's how. But their budget, you know, they actually lowered their overall budget and then did a different allocation. And then we almost lost King County. Remember, we almost lost King County for a year, which is, you know, and the allocation of it would have been a huge hit for us. But King County stayed on board, thank goodness. Because it's by population is the distribution. So we would have gotten killed.
That's how we pay for you guys to go up to Legislature.
Exactly.
We'll serve you those nice lunches and stuff.
Yeah.
That's right.
That's
supposed to be coming back smarter than you left.
I felt like I got fire hosed with information, very useful information.
Yeah, their training sessions were
really
that way.
Good.
What else you got there?
Okay, this is another WASAC invoice, and this one is news to me. There's a timber coordinator, apparently, and every county pays some amount, and our amount's
$445.
$445
for portion of the timber tax. The timber tax revenues that come in. statewide, we have a timber coordinator that specifically works to enhance the timber tax that we get. You'll get, like, every quarter or a year, we get a letter saying, here's how much money you got from the state for your timber. We don't have much. Skamania is huge. Some of the other Cowlitz, did you guys get a bunch?
Yeah. There's a subgroup in Wasack called the Timber Counties.
Yeah.
So are our dues proportional to our benefit, or
yes.
Is it flat rate?
No, it's proportion to benefit.
Everything is proportional by size or use.
So the counties that get more revenue pay a higher amount?
We get more money.
Are you convincing me?
I don't know. The sarcasm comes
like
through
the
on the table.
We also get that off federal land, too.
So. Okay, lastly, and thank goodness, is NACO, National Association of Counties, membership dues for 2014 in the amount of $7,242. And for that, we get that really cool magazine that's in the lunchroom.
Thank God.
And National Advocacy on County Issues.
What about the dues for National Association of Senior Policy Analysts? I'm the president again.
Are you the only member?
Do you have that on your business card?
You just made it up. Yeah, I was going to say. We have an association for
a nonprofit organization.
Yeah, send us an invoice. We'll see how it goes.
If you get a $20,000 invoice, you know where it's going.
So do we want to be a member of this group?
Waco?
Yes. Okay, to pay? All right.
Yeah.
Thank you. Very good.
That
now,
really came out that when we had our Waco meeting down here, that how important it is to support this group on a national basis. Because we also get federal timberland dollars, too. That'd be a lot for that.
Well, a lot of the federal regulatory pieces that they try to come down on us with or funding pieces that they try to take away, NACO's the one that fights for us.
Okay, well, thank you. I'll try to not do that again. paragraph 1.3, I think Axel now is in the barrel.
Yeah, well, I'll do them in opposite order because one's easier. This is a deed packet. You guys asked, there's two deed positions open. You guys asked to go out. We've done that. So this is your packet.
We skipped over 1.3, what was it?
I'm going to get to that one second. I'm reversing because this one's easier because this is just information for you to take and then come back next week. Review those applicants. Now, the thing to remind you is we do have two already serving applicants who have reapplied. So that's Ott. I think it's Ott and Eric. I've worked with them both a lot. They're both great people. So they have reapplied, but you did want to go out. So we got other applications in. So take a look. And we'll be looking for your guys' appointment
and did
selections
they include
over this week.
Their resumes as well as just like everybody else?
I believe they, I hope they did.
I see one.
They should have submitted something in terms of materials.
But some of the forefathers of that organization.
Who do you see?
Kurt Galimos, I saw. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
I just want to add any of those.
Gaithers here.
Great. Okay. So, and any of those, Axel, make sure that if they're incumbent, that they don't just assume we have it on file, that they update it and give it to us like everybody else. Great. Okay, that's homework.
On the Developmental Disabilities Advisory Board, the question on this one is there's three openings coming up. We have three people serving that want to reapply. And the direction that you've given Jennifer and I for this is to go out and open it up and advertise for everyone. I want just to come back and check in with you because this is a statutorily created board and these folks are pretty well specifically qualified to be on this board. Mm-hmm. And so I just want to check in with you. We do have three internal applicants that want to continue serving. It sounds like they've been recommended by the staff to continue or they've been serving well. Do you want to go out anyways and just recruit, or do you want to look at a reappointing
these folks? We just do a press release on that, right?
We would send out a press release saying there's three vacancies on the Developmental Disabilities Board, and these are the statutory requirements to serve in each of the positions. So, I mean, you've got.
I think by doing that, going out there, we will have fulfilled the obligation. And at the same time, we consider those who have already been there.
Okay, so advertise.
Yeah, keeps us out of trouble.
Yeah, I think that would be good. Okay. Also, can you know David Kelly at Southwest Washington Asian Disability. Can you also let him know about these vacancies? Because I highly respect his input.
Okay.
And yeah, he may know of individuals that would be very interested.
It would surprise me if... one of his staff isn't on here, but I'll find that okay. out. They probably are. Okay. Thank so you. we will go out and we will consider the internal applicants with the others.
Okay.
Well, you have the floor. Do you want to cover Hoof Rock?
Yeah. I think I got one more though. I've got a couple of things. I've got so those two. You guys may remember this. This is kind of a holdover issue from last year, and things kind of with just changes taking place and everything. We were going to do some thinning at Camp Hope at one point. Jim Vandeling was working on that. Senator Benton emailed me because he had talked to Jim, because Jim said, "Hey, I got this thing teed up. All the permits are done. Everything's ready. We could cut tomorrow, but we probably need to circle back in with the board because it's been so long." So what this is up there at Camp Hope, they want to basically, it's become to a point to where it's pretty unhealthy and it's almost getting to fire danger, where they just want to go in and thin. The big ask, I guess, is that we have a lease and a contract up there with somebody to operate Camp Home for, so we also have cabins, I haven't been there, but as I understand, there's cabins and facilities up there as part of that lease that we own. So what they would like from you guys is just an understanding, and Jim Vandeling and Senator Benton support going forward with this, but they want you guys in the loop and the understanding that go ahead and thin. If we make any revenue off it, they're estimating $20,000-$25,000 in revenue from the thinning. Can they put it back into the capital structures at Camp Hope?
Is this part of the sustainable forestry initiative that they're
pursuing? That was one of our concerns, is that this would be confused with that.
Is it not?
No, I think Livingston Mountain and Green Mountain were the two that you were concerned about during the budget supplemental and the sustainable forestry initiative.
I wasn't
initiative.
Concerned about those two places. I was concerned about having a sustainable forestry initiative on any publicly owned properties without us having a work session to say, this is why we're doing it, and this is the benefits to the citizens and all of that. But I don't know if Camp Hope was not part of that.
That was before.
It was a specific budget allocation. So if any of those dollars are being used for this, then they would be subject to the budget proviso that was passed by the board. If it's not, then it's not.
Yeah, my understanding is this initiative precedes the sustainable forestry initiative in that budget request.
And that was, I think maybe that's probably Don and Jim's concern, was because we started this groundwork early last year and we got pretty involved and Jim got it all buttoned up, but then that came up at the work session, and so I think that's just why they wanted you guys to.
So they're just being cautious.
Just in the loop.
Okay. No, that's good.
Yep.
All right. Yeah. Good. And Jim's the old timer that has been a great steward over these things. I trust his judgment on that.
Yeah, he's plus the utility of that property for the upcoming, you know, camping season will be improved if we do this. What's the time frame?
Pretty safety too.
He gave me, I have here a copy of sort of the, I have a copy of the permit and then, you know, the
design,
forest management
the
plan.
Groundwork that's going to be done for the sustainable forestry initiative.
Forest stewardship plan.
No, that's just for this one.
Okay.
So the groundwork is what we paid for. And so just to make sure we dotted our I's and crossed our T's and I don't get in trouble, could you double check for me that none of the dollars spent for the groundwork of this were dollars that are subject to the budget proviso that said nothing will occur unless, until we've had a work session. Because that would be the only thing for me. I mean, I think, you know.
Because then you're spending money prior to.
It's good. They should be. They need to do this work. It's just, I want to make sure that we're doing this right.
Okay.
What's the name of that specific money? Sustainable.
I don't know. There was a line item in the budget for it, and there's a proviso associated with it, and they'll know. I don't think any of the money. I don't think it's the same money.
It's not. But so we'll confirm it.
Confirm.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
All right. We'll confirm that, but then we'll give them the thumbs up if that's good.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Another quick thing is with the law changed as it relates to scrap metal business licensing.
Oh, yeah.
And
didn't we get an angry letter? Didn't we get a letter from the sheriff about that?
Yeah, he's good. It's off his list. We Axel contacted.
Because it's on Axel's list, or
that's right.
Well, he contacted the state directly, and we're good to go. We just need to provide a point of contact, and that'll be Marty Snell.
So if you guys are okay with it, the way we're going to work it is we got to send this up to the state, which gives the state our point of contact for who can approve the location of a scrap metal business. The way it'll work is that person will need to come in now to our permit center to get the authorization, which then they have to send to the state. When we get it, we'll treat it a little bit like a liquor license. We'll send it to the sheriff so he knows about the location, any concerns. Marty will look at it from the zoning land use perspective, sign off, give it back to him.
He might have to go in and do that. I've been to your place, man. I saw all this grass you got there. You may have to go get that.
He stores it.
Come and pick it up.
He doesn't process it. He stores it, right?
Yeah, he's trying to get rid of it.
He was supposed to come and pick it up. Not my fault.
That's true.
So Marty doesn't know this yet. But so the way the statute reads, though, is the person to sign off on the location either has to be the sheriff or the county commissioners or their designee. So I may need you to designate Marty or somebody else when I send this to the state. So I'll let Marty know that.
Is that a zoning thing?
After I buy him lunch or something.
Actually, that's just a zoning thing for scrap metal businesses, or it just stops people from gathering.
There's so much
crap around.
There's
their
so
house.
Much illegal
well,
activity.
Well, it's so that anybody
to
who, if a bunch of tweakers steal a bunch of copper from Clark Public Utilities and take it to somebody and they buy it, they're just tightening up on the regulation of it.
This actually reminds me a lot of what we got into with the discussion with the massage parlors and all that stuff yesterday, because this is the state trying to do kind of what we looked at doing, or what I was looking at doing with code. It's making these people be less transient, that you've got to come in and show us who you are, where your location is, and have somebody put their face and name and information to an organization so that there's some credibility behind it. That's basically what it's trying to do.
Having made my living on that for 18 years, hauling for non-ferrous metals such as Spencer's, they make the people show proof of who they are when they bring it in to
sell. Yeah, you get to show them your license.
And that's all you have to do.
That way, well, now they got
there's some accountability along the way. But I can remember chasing my battery covers down to the scrap dealers. And getting there at about the same time as the guy who just stole them.
But I've seen jalopy trucks loaded to the rim. I mean, just oversized load going to the little yard down here.
Yeah,
it looks like
you're not quite sure.
They don't look licensed
it,
or anything.
It's going to be left there. Yeah,
yep.
We've seen it.
The hoof rot thing. I've drafted a letter, and Holly helped me make it readable. And I don't know. I don't have a huge update for you yet because I don't know where to go with it. Where I was going, the angle I was going with the hoof rot letter was to pick up on some of the stuff that Bruce has talked to us about herbicide and what I've discovered through the studies that I've read and other things, and then fold that into a pitch for some state funding to look into the disease. And because Fish and Wildlife, through Governor Inslee's budget, have right now a line item for an extra $200,000 to go into looking specifically at hoof disease in these elk, and mainly that would pay for an extra state veterinarian. We only have one veterinarian right now, and she's in Spokane. But I just have, I'm kind of losing, I'll probably bring it back next week, because it's just not,
I
don't know what my angle
is. Who is it to?
It's to our legislative delegation, asking them to support the governor's budget. But
yeah. I guess where I wanted to go was thinking, Are we being effective in our request, or are we just being ignored? Is there something we can truly do, or have we done our part? I just want to know that our efforts aren't falling on deaf ears.
And I think, the problem is it's a causation problem. And so we've had two meetings, and we're coming up on our third meeting. And this is the question that I've started to ask the people running the meetings is, because what they're really trying to do is they're sending these samples off to find out if this is a bacteria that's transmissible that's causing this. And until we know, I feel like we're just going to all kind of sit there and look at each other. And so what I'm pushing for, because I've started to look into this, they've sent us a couple more studies on these two elk herds specifically. And I think there's enough evidence that show that the habitat is very poor, and that this is more than just a bacteria. It may be a bacteria, but their nutritional value and what they have for summer forage and everything that's happening up there on this area of very industrialized timber, and the state timber is also very heavily sprayed, more so than anywhere else in the state.
So I think I heard from Bruce that he thought it was more on private timberland.
Well, if you
and is the herb, or he thought it was the herbicide being used,
He's not off the mark. I mean, if you look at Region 5, and if you look at where the St. Helens and Willapaw Hills are, I'd say 50% or more of the property is owned by private timber, mainly warehousing. That's also some of the largest areas of state-owned timberlands. And what I did the other day, because I was interested in this, is I looked up the last, let's say, 10 years worth of herbicide contracts by the state. And the most significant herbicide application that's happened is in this Pacific Cascades region. I mean, we're talking significantly more than anywhere else around the state. Why? Because they're harvesting more timber there. It makes sense. But, you know, so I just think that I think, you know, where we need to go with this committee is, well, in the meantime, if we can't prove or we're going to continue trying to prove that it's a bacteria, we can at least talk about nutrition and habitat in the meantime. I mean, that's productive and constructive. Mm-hmm. Because we know one of the studies that was like 200 pages long, they looked at elk all over the western United States, and the elk in these two herds had, you know, the lowest body mass, the lowest body fat, and the worst reproductive rates. So something's going on there. Then they had a student from Alberta University do a study on Weyerhaeuser's actual clear cuts to say, well, let's look at it. Let's look at a clear cut that was sprayed and one that isn't, and compare the two and see if it, you know, does herbicide really work? Well, it turns out it does what it says it does. In the first 2 to 3 years, it you know, kills everything, to include species of plants that these elk choose to forage on. So, now what he also shows, though, is after year three or so, they start to level out and they almost come back around to the same level that an unsprayed clear cut would be at. So it's, you know, it's in that initial 2 to 3 year time frame where it really impacts it. And, you know, the question there is, with proper forest practices, could you do things correctly so there's always enough forage? You know, I don't know. So, you know, I think there's enough evidence that we need to be having a serious habitat conversation about these two herds and how that relates to this disease, or at the least exasperates the problem. You know, if they have a bacteria, well, if they don't have good nutrition and they're not going into the winter as healthy as they should, they're certainly not going to get over a sickness or an illness. So,
I guess where I want to go on this is that how much more of county resources do we put into this, or do we just ask for the state to become more accountable?
And that's kind of where I'm at with this letter and the angle. You know, it's like I'm writing it to the legislators.
So that's our involvement. See, we're concerned. We want the state to be accountable to us.
Yeah.
Because it's affecting parts of Clark County.
And I know Bruce kind of cornered Senator Benton on it last night about getting involved with some legislation. I know that they have a meeting with Senator Cleveland on Saturday.
Actually, good.
Be realistic, yeah.
And I know Dan Cothran, the commissioner in Wakayakum County, is setting up a meeting with the 19th legislators about it. So, I mean, I think that's where we've got to go now, is maybe push this habitat conversation and the nutrition, but the legislators are the ones that are
supporting the line item, obviously.
So, yeah. I think for now we're on the right track.
I'm curious, hasn't the Department of Ecology been interested in this?
We've been involved with them.
Well, I called Department of Ecology because I was interested in how they monitor forest practices and whether or not. And so their angle is an interesting one because they're very worried about stream and water quality.
Right.
So they're down there testing for herbicides in the stream and the creeks and how that might, you know, impact fish and stuff. They're not so much concerned about soil or the plants or the animals in the area. It's really, ecology's focus is very much stream-based. And that's why in those forest practices they have buffers. You know, they're not supposed to fly over and spray within 100 feet of the creek or whatever it is. And so they do pay attention and monitor for that. But when it comes to large mammals or wildlife or even the vegetation or soils, they don't really focus on it.
So the Department of Ecology is really misnamed. It should be the Department of Water Quality, right?
Mm-hmm.
I kind of said that on the phone when I talked to him.
Yeah.
Of course, we don't want them to expand.
Yeah.
So they didn't share with you any test results or anything they could identify that in the water?
They don't. You know, and the hard part about this is I read up a lot on the toxicity of these herbicides. They're not very toxic. I mean, I'm convinced. I don't buy into the conspiracy that we're poisoning these animals, because most of the stuff
intentionally.
It sounds like you could drink it. I mean, it's not. What it does is it floats down, it hits the plants, and it impacts the photosynthesis. So it's not really, you know, it's not. I guess I don't think it's a toxic issue. I think it's, if anything, it's just taking out so much of that summer nutrition that they need. It's just making them sick. They're just unhealthy.
So have you been? Go ahead.
No, I've just been marking that's kind of a different spin as to nutritional lack of nutrition versus actually being infected with something on their hooves.
Well, they do get infected, but it's because their immune systems might be suppressed because of the poor nutrition.
Yeah.
It's complex, but if you... The disease is called laminitis, and I read a lot about it in cows, and that's the hoof problem, where the hoof actually detaches from the leg, and what the main cause for that is this acidosis in the rumen, which is, they have five stomachs. These animals have five stomachs, and if they eat something or too much of something with too many carbohydrates, or their diet changes too quickly, that cranks up and goes to work, and it just creates a lack of blood flow to their hoofs, and their hooves start falling apart and falling off. So, you know, my question to the veterinarian was, you know, could it be that maybe we're spraying these places and it's doing a real good job wiping out three or four of the things they really choose to eat, and so they're overcompensating on that fifth or fourth thing, and that, you know, too much, maybe whereas they would only normally want to eat 20% of that as their diet, they're eating 80% of it.
So it's an imbalanced diet.
Their, you know, but I don't know. I mean, I have no idea. It's just, we just know that there's a lot of sick elk roaming around. And a new thing is we're getting reports, and I'm asking people to start reporting deformed or they have like rubbery horns. Their horns are not forming correctly. And so I asked the vet that. I said, well, if we're looking for a bacteria that impacts the hoof, is it common that their horns would be messed up? Because horns, you know, that's fairly common for a lack of nutrition and minerals. Those
floppy
are all,
horns?
Yeah, those are all minerals.
So you don't want to shoot one of those and mount it on your wall?
Not necessarily.
You wouldn't be able to hang one.
Well, my question is, on the other or adjacent counties, have you been in contact with them? Because I would expect we're one out of many where there's a bunch of elk in these other counties.
I mentioned Dan Cothran. He's a county commissioner in Wakayakum, and he's on our committee. Then Jim Meisner is on there for Calitz. And so we all kind of are working together. And I'm going to try to go to the meetings where Dan sets up with the legislators. Scamania, I hope I'm not doing...
Aren't you in Skamania where you're at?
I hung in Skamania.
Yeah. I thought your maps showed that Skamania wasn't as effective.
And that's the thing is, I mean, really, really, once you cross into Nashville, and that's another kind of conspiracy theory thing, but once you cross that boundary and you get into the National Forest where they no longer cut timber or spray, there's no reports of it.
No.
You know, when you look at the map, it's all right there.
The private timberland.
In Calitz County, basically.
All state.
Well, I was wondering about WASAC. Have you been in touch with them to make sure we got good networking going on between any of the counties that have elk?
I'll be up there tonight. I'll make sure.
Okay.
I'll ask.
Bring it up.
Yeah,
it's good to have that coalition group.
It would be good. Right. In fact, really, they're the common link where they can be both a source of us sending you, make sure they have a copy of our letter, and that the other counties can draw from that, and so that we're not all just simply individual counties sending individual letters up to the governor. Rather, we're also communicating with each other as a coalition.
Yeah, if there's anything you want me to send with me to Josh.
When are you going tomorrow?
And I'm leaving after this.
Oh,
I'm leaving at 4. We have a roundtable at 6. So, yeah,
so
if there's anything.
So there's not a danger eating the meat. And that was a big question.
We're not sure.
Well,
we don't think so. But
so far, they've said no, there isn't.
Yeah,
but I've talked to a lot of people who
value
lack
of nutrition.
Sure.
Then
I think where it's a problem,
poisonous.
Turn it into jerky.
Where it's a problem is you have an elk trying to walk for a long period of time on half a leg, and then that gets infected, and then you've got an issue. I don't think the actual hoof rot disease necessarily.
Well, and in the hunter's guide this year, I mean, the WDFW manual, they said, you know, they had hoof rot in there, and they said, look, if you encounter a sick animal, don't eat it. You know, so you know, if you harvest, sick animal, don't eat it. So they're taking a cautious approach as far as that goes.
Okay.
All right. So I'll probably have something for you to think about signing next week.
All right.
Okay. We skipped commissioner reports, so we can.
I was going to kind of leave that to last.
Okay, kind of like commissioner communications. Okay, Tina should have distributed to you four vacancy review forms.
Yep.
I don't need
some questions and some concerns.
Are these for next week, though?
Yes. Typically, we give them to you, and then you look at them, and then if you have questions, you can ask me between now and next Wednesday.
I'll just make a statement then.
Okay.
One of them has a 70% funding on grants, and it's a full-time position being asked for.
Mm-hmm.
So that was kind of a light for me.
Versus a project position? Versus a project employee. In other words, you're hiring a full-time permanent employee.
Well, which one are we talking about? Is that Catherine Kroll?
Is who?
Yes.
Catherine Kroll.
That's 30% grants from federal grant programs and the State Foundation of Public Health Funds. I'm not sure if that's a grant. So it's 60% and then 40% general fund.
Yeah, and so I wouldn't... So that was part of my concern for a full-time employee. And then the other one...
And just to tag on to that. So the potential question to ask there is, since this is one-time grant funded, at least portion of it, should that be considered a full-time project employee, a temporary employee?
So when we have that grant money like this, is that a new grant we just received?
This is an ongoing grant program. The previous incumbent was funded over a long period with these funds.
So we don't know when that grant runs out, or if we're just starting a new grant time frame.
I think the grants. Yeah, the grants have a finite time period, but they're typically renewed year after year or on a biennial basis because, I mean, if you look at this program, this is communicable disease prevention and control. I mean, this is a vital program.
And that along those lines, is that that's a priority for us to fully fund this and maybe not something else that's not directly related to communicable diseases.
Do you want to get more information on that then?
No, I'm just, we'll probably talk about it more.
Okay.
I just want to throw some things out there that
cool.
Food for thought.
Okay.
The other one that was a great Callaway.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have a vacated date. And one of the things that we're looking at. This one was pretty quick. Equipment rental revolving fund mechanical repair.
There's nothing on when that was vacated.
No date vacated.
Okay.
So that was a question.
Yeah, I'll get that. Yeah, the equipment rental and revolving fund. That fund, what happens is people have vehicles and they pay rents on the vehicles, and the rent has a number of components to it. One is capital replacement, the other is maintenance and repair, and the mechanics are funded out of the maintenance and repair portion of the vehicle charges, and so they just use a portion of those funds to pay for the mechanics.
Okay. The other one was a maintenance specialist, I think. Park maintenance. First thing went through my mind was we're not necessarily doing parks right now. Do we have to fulfill it right now, or can we wait a month or two? And then the other one that crossed my mind, and I think this is an old, something that was left in the old job description, herbicide application. Remember the problem that we had, separation, vegetation management?
Yeah.
With this is that we were having one person putting a herbicide on it, another person mowing it off.
Yeah.
And so we might want to look at that position.
Yeah, I think the parks folks do spot applications. I think vegetation management does the larger scale applications.
And also some requirements of certificate to be able to put herbicides on public places. Just one of those things that, and there again. Because of the time frame under a reorganization, does that have to be filled momentarily or wait a month or two? And then the other one was filled
Bill Bjerke.
Replacement was that we're not, I'm concerned where our number of employees that we were anticipating for our parks department, our new parks department.
Right, right. The plan that the board approved was to hire a parks manager, and Bill Bjerke was the parks maintenance supervisor.
Right. I didn't know if there's a combining of that position, and then he stepped up to do manager.
No, he was promoted to the management position, and that's a position the board approved. Uh-huh. And he also approved backfilling that position. So we increased the staffing at the county side by four. Yeah. Board approved, and we're still saving all the money that Pete projected that we would save, and I think it was 400 some odd thousand annually. And so, pardon?
440.
Yeah, 440. Right, but that's based on the higher 880. So what we need to do is we need somebody in charge of parks maintenance, and since Bill Bjerke is now the overall parks manager, he's got both sides. We need to replace Bill so that we have a maintenance supervisor.
Do you know if we have anybody in-house that would move up and would qualify for that? I would think we might have.
Well, what they second down here,
inevitably someone down, you know, here, they're qualified, sure, they'll jump.
It says proposed recruitment is an internal promotion or transfer.
Oh, that's, yeah.
So it looks like we've got fully trained people that we're looking at.
All right. That's the only thing that was.
Okay, so we'll discuss those again next week. Okay, now commissioner reports.
Leaving after this for the first legislative steering committee, we weren't sure it was going to happen, so I hadn't mentioned it before. It was kind of a to be decided because the legislature doesn't come into session until next week. So, but there is one that they're doing, so I'm heading up. They have a roundtable at 6. A couple of lobbyists, Gary Chandler from AWB, and I forget who the other one's going to come in and talk about kind of like what Mark Brown did and say, hey, this is what we think is going to happen. They have someone coming in to discuss the healthcare implications, kind of, you know, what the work session that we did covered, very similar. And then tomorrow, regular leg steering. The next one's on the 23rd, and I'll make sure that the materials for that, that I get it to you early, and so that if you're able to come, it'll be Thursday the 23rd, and then every other Thursday from then on, and then they have Wednesday nights
at 6 up there in Olympia.
Yeah, and then so at 6 p.m. on Wednesday evenings, the WASAC staff, and then they try to bring in a lobbyist or a legislator or something to come in. They do a roundtable kind of pizza feed at 6, and so for those people that are coming in the evening ahead of it, so like the one I'm doing tonight. So it's generally at 6 p.m. roundtable and 8 a.m. meetings on Thursday, and like I said, for the 23rd, I'll make sure you get the materials way ahead of time too, so if it's something that you want to come up for, that'd be awesome.
You might have to bring a salad plate for.
Yeah, exactly.
So you said it's every other Thursday?
Yeah, it's every other Thursday during the session. 8 a.m. is when the actual meetings start, and then they go from 8 to 10. We're in meetings where they do updates, where staff does updates of all of the issue areas and what bills have dropped and where they are, and we as commissioners can ask questions about it. If they need direction on support this, don't support it, whatever, they get that at that point. Then from 10 to noon, they send us onto the Hill. Which has been a really productive change from what it used to be, where they'll send us up onto the Hill with groups, small groups, and they'll have, like, I usually will lead a small group of commissioners in to talk with legislators. They take people who have either been commissioners for a while or people who have experience working with the legislature or who were legislators, try to lead groups of commissioners, go up, talk with specific legislators about our priorities or whatever issues are popping at the time, and then we come back together at noon for those who can do it, come back at noon, have lunch, and then kind of wrap back around and say, all right, what'd you hear, you know, when you were up there. So usually it's 8 to 1 total, you know, on a Thursday, and, you know, I'm usually back well before 5. I mean, you know, even if I have other meetings with legislators, I'm usually back at 5. No. Usually, yeah, I go up Wednesday nights, and if
can't
I have
find,
meetings...
You can't find a lobbyist?
No, I know, seriously. Well, usually that's Wednesday nights. Like, I'll see Burgess tonight, and I usually try to meet with a couple of legislators on, you know, I'll go to the round table and then try to meet with a couple of legislators afterwards to lobby them up a little bit. So, and always bring a lobbyist,
yeah. We'd be out there on the balcony or on the... We'd be getting ready for dinner, and we'd look around, and we'd go like this.
Exactly.
Okay, great. Thanks, Steve.
Yeah, of course. Of course. And then next Tuesday, I was invited to sit in the gallery for the State of the State. So it's one of those things that, you know, to continue being connected at all with them and continue having a voice up there. You know, I'm going to go to the State of the State and see what Governor Inslee has. Yeah. Next Tuesday, I think it's at 10 a.m.
So we won't be at the...
Exactly. I won't be at the hearing next Tuesday. So.
Last one I went to was Governor Locke, and I thought, oh, I didn't vote for him.
It's amazing the speeches
next,
are a little...
Then the next 4 years,
like, oh, that's why. Yeah, exactly. But it is good. The State of the State,
it
gives you a good indication of what the priorities are going to be for the governor and the governor's office as they move into the next piece of it. And then you get a chance to hear from some of the leadership on both sides of it as to... their reactions to all of that. So it's usually a good chance to get some insights into what's going to happen.
Do they still put the tents all the way around the Capitol and have food all around there?
I haven't seen that. No, for the inauguration, they didn't even, I don't know. I didn't go to the inaugural stuff, but they do it for that. I haven't seen it for the State of the State, but I don't know. Maybe. Well, I mean, I guess the inauguration, doesn't it happen like the same day as the State of the State a lot of times or something? I don't know.
All
I'm not sure.
Together.
Yeah, I don't know.
Where do you suggest that park would have gone then?
So there's some of the meetings, well, all the legislative meetings are going on at the Capitol campus. The old library is now a cafeteria. So basically on the south side of the Capitol campus, there are neighborhoods, and they have like 2-hour parking in there, and they're pretty tight about it. Like the parking patrols are pretty, they come around.
So don't park there.
Exactly. On the north side of the campus, but a lot of people try it, and they end up getting tickets. So just on the north side of campus, there is a surface lot that always has spaces in it, and it has long-term parking. And I'll get the actual address for you, because it is the best as far as that. Some people will park... There are a few spots at the WASAC building. Behind the WASAC building, they have a few spots. They're full most of the time. And then people hike it up from WASAC. But I swear by the surface lot that's just on the north side of the... You know what I'm talking about? It's like it's like a parking garage almost, but the only place that you park is... you just kind of go up a little ramp, and it's a surface lot in the old TVW. It's part of the old TVW building. Behind that.
They're behind the Senate building. There's some.
Yeah.
And just toward the freeway from there. And then there's another lot down behind the judge's building.
That's the one I'm talking about. It's down by... you're talking about right by the judge's building. I think they locked those down.
Behind the judge's building.
You're a legislator, man. You can park wherever you want.
Up by the Capitol.
Locals, we can't do that.
Mansion.
Yeah. Well, I think... I don't know.
It used to be open.
I'll have to check. I haven't seen that one be open. But anyway, we'll get you a couple options as far as that goes. Yeah, of course. That's all I had.
Right. Anything?
I got something. Joel from Joel's Farm Market. Joel Bedouin, I think he pronounced his last name. I went over to Heritage. He invited me to come over to Heritage Farm yesterday in... shared a little bit of an inspiration he had. He's done some homework to put a outbuilding up out there that he hopes to be able to use for a true local farmer's market. And he's actually done quite a bit of homework on it. Here's an example plan. And it's something that is done commonly in many communities across the United States.
Is it on 78th Street?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And on 78th Street, there's
basically where the food bank would have gone, like in that space along there. Sorry.
There's that relatively new traffic signal at 25th Avenue there. It tees into 78th Street and does not go into the farm.
Yes. Uh-huh.
And then there's the driveway entrance, which some people say that's kind of dangerous to get in and out. They need a traffic cop there to be able to have any event. What he's suggesting is that tee at that new traffic signal, they actually stub that and put make that an entrance for the Heritage Farm, and that'll greatly increase the safety there. And he sketched out some things. These are all papers from him. So if this is 78th Street here, this is the traffic signal. This little area here, it's kind of uneven. It would need to be leveled. And he's basically you would gravel this whole thing, and it would provide lots of parking for the farm. And you would have a simple pole building there, and have room if you want to in the future add another one or another one. And the idea there, it's different than the farmer's market. Farmer's market, it's not really a farmer's market. It's
like a Saturday market kind
of thing. Yeah, Saturday market. They get stuff from, they're not farmers. And so he has a lot of inspiration on this, and the idea would be just simply starting with the conversation, look at what would be involved when it comes to funding, and he's actually got quotes on some prices here, which would probably be low compared to what it would really cost. He's got $82,000, $82,000 to do all that work, and he actually has grading costs and that kind of thing from real providers. So basically, it'd be pouring a big slab of concrete, putting a pole barn over it, it'd be all open, and it would be not only used during the growing season for all the local farmers, mm-hmm. It's for local farmers, which is very different than just a market. And then the rest of the year, it would be useful for lots of other events out there. So it would make the Heritage Farm a much more community-engaged facility, increase the safety. It would be something that would be there. He would be, the farming community would be so excited if something like that could happen. So what it really comes down to is having some conversations. So I'll be happy to follow through on that and have some conversations.
We can direct staff. You don't have to. We can. I've met with Joe on this very same thing, and I totally agree with the there are already cost estimates associated with stubbing the road, because when we were going to have the food bank go in there, that's exactly what we were going to be doing, is stubbing that road in to actually help them get in and out. So we have some estimates associated with that we can get back.
We actually have a technical advisory committee that Laura Peterson, across the way. She's the organizer of that. The typical process is that people like this make proposals to that group, and they vet it.
Totally same idea.
And then there are certain requirements But I mean, I'm fully supportive of a farmer's market. I don't believe that his cost estimates are very close to accurate.
Probably not.
We would need to run water.
The joy of it is like directing staff to look at. I would love to see them. I'd love to see this come to fruition. Mm-hmm. The thing I've told Joe, and I met out, did the same kind of thing, met out with them. The two issues. One of them is the cost of the stub, and we got to figure out how much it would be in that piece of it. And the second piece of it is that there's been lots of community conversation about having a community center on that property over the long haul in that location, not the same exact space, but in that location that would also require the stub road and that could actually benefit from the same thing. And just so people aren't stepping on each other's toes, I love the idea of sending to this technical advisory group and say, hey, look, look at it. Yeah. You know, because I think it'd be awesome.
So yeah, and then part of the map
would be look at stubbing off that road.
Yeah, that's what they'd have to, you know, they'd have to look at that and look at, you know, how do they organize the space to make sure that there's space for this and any potential expansion of this or other uses. Yeah.
Yeah, and so green light to direct staff to check it out.
Totally. Yeah.
He's got it very, very simplified. He's trying to do bare bones.
He's awesome.
Able to launch it off the ground.
Yeah.
But I wonder if we end up just instead of having an open pole barn, if you have roll-up doors and add some bathrooms and
just like that picture you brought.
Yeah. Where it could be, then it's a multi-use building.
There's one there in Olympia, so when you go up there.
Yeah.
You got to show them where it is.
Yeah.
Oh yeah. Actually,
it's down by Bay.
Roundabout at the end of that roundabout.
Very nice.
And I think if you do that building.
Now we're talking sewer.
It's just a concrete slab.
Well, but I heard Commissioner Redor talk about restrooms, multi-use.
Oh, that was him.
Did you say that?
Oh, okay. I said that. I'm not saying to do it, but I'm saying...
Cost curve goes like this.
It would be nice to have.
Well, that's part of the research to find out what would be practical, what can we do? Mm-hmm. Is there what would be the source of funding for that?
That's a good question.
Prayer.
Ultimately, it would you're going to look at road fund for something like that to be able to, you know, to be able to do it. Unless we were able to get grant funds associated with it, which is a potential, you know.
Right.
But as far as the stubbing of the road and the infrastructure. Underlying it, yeah. I mean,
the stubbing of the road would be road fund, but once you cross the boundary of the property,
the
road fund can't do it.
Right.
Now, We have done some research into the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation and other charitable, you know, the Pew yeah. Charitable Trust. We did get a grant to build a low impact development parking lot on the on the west side along 78th Street.
Yeah,
and we're working to get that going.
Is the same general area we're talking about.
No, it's the opposite side of the property.
The east side.
This proposal is for the east side.
The west side?
Yeah, that's where the parking lot's going to go.
Interesting.
Well, that's where we have the
That's fine.
The Harvest Fun Day and all that.
Yeah, totally.
And you know, the long term plan is to have beer fests out there, you know, wine and jazz festivals, the whole nine yards. And a farmer's market is in the master plan, so the technical advisory team will probably be very excited about this.
Totally, yeah, because it is part of the master plan.
Yep.
So
does the county own that property right there at the traffic signal?
Because that's the street.
So just to the west of it, yes. To the south of it is private. To the east is private. But yeah, we have right of way. We have significant right of way, and then we own the property. Is if you stubbed it and you head south, you know, if you just kind of started driving a tractor through it, driving south, we own it. And then if you just turned right, if you headed west, yeah, we own all that.
Okay.
Now there are issues associated with wetlands and other environmental constraints in that vicinity that we got to worry about.
Well,
a little
this
bit,
stays.
It should be on.
There is little drainage.
Yeah, but we should be on the north of it.
We
should
are.
Be.
Ooh,
yeah.
You got to not call it a ditch because DES people will get upset with you.
Yeah.
It's the headwaters of G Creek, is it?
But I love the idea of the technical. That's awesome. I would love to see that.
And honestly, that's what they call it. Now, I don't know why I can't recall the creek.
No, that's G Creek.
So can we get direction to actually look into this then?
Yes. Now, the last issue I'll mention is that depending on the number of trips generated, Public Works says that it might trigger the need for a north south. Okay, thank you. Great.
Sorry, the master plan, they argued with us for a while that somehow we were going to have to rip a road all the way up over the hill and down to 63rd and have a north-south connector along our property line, which is topographically ridiculous, environmentally ridiculous, and from a functional standpoint doesn't make any sense. So we, in the master plan, said, look, we're not.
It would also escalate it to the point where it's not going to happen.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, you just draw a little driveway in and out, and it's fine.
Great.
You know?
Okay. Great.
So, okay.
Look good. What else you got?
Okay. Do you have anything
for us? Holly, you have anything for us?
No.
If you're making notes for Mary, one thing in our conversations about the state of the county address, we didn't mention anything about freeholders.
Okay.
And that has to be mentioned in the state of the county address.
That's a good point. When do they get together next? Do we know?
Saturday. 9 a.m.
Oh, you know. Okay. Saturday at 9 a.m. Cool. Yeah. How's it going?
Next time is two Saturdays.
I think they're really going at a very quick pace.
Good.
Well, we are.
Good.
Kelly.
Nancy seems like she's doing good.
Yes. Florence Wheeler, you got the email from her about fireworks. She's looking for some feedback on what the next step would be post-vote. I just want to see if you have any perspective on how to respond to
that. We're going to make a change according to people's requests. Well, we're going to lengthen that, too.
So we have a lengthen it too, guys. But we've talked about it, Commissioner Medora said. I mean, it's an ordinance change. So we have to, and what we talked about before is we need a schedule of like what's required to make an ordinance change, and then you start putting dates on it, working backwards from what you actually have to do. But I haven't seen the like here are the steps we would have to take for this, and then when would it take effect? I mean, we haven't gotten any of that.
So just let her know we are definitely responding.
It takes a while.
What I would suggest is we tackle the first five first.
We are.
Those are already scheduled. Yeah.
Yeah, as far as hearings, yeah, we totally are. It's the only thing we had asked for is for the fireworks piece was what is even, I mean, it is an ordinance change, so what's necessary? Before we can even schedule, we need to know, all right, what are the steps that are necessary? Does it have to go to Planning Commission? Does it have, you know, and I think it does. So if it goes to Planning Commission and comes to us, and then there's an effective date that's later.
It can't.
It's just, so somebody needs to draft up for us a schedule of, like.
So I have some good news.
What's necessary?
Lori Volkman is still working here part-time.
Yeah, on contract. Yeah.
I met her downstairs on the elevator.
Yeah. She's wrapping up a couple of things for us.
What are you doing still? We just had too many changes too much, and she's still here part-time. And so that's exciting because she was involved in the
drafting of the advisory
resolutions.
Yeah.
All right.
I think Kelly has more.
Oh, shoot. Go ahead.
Shall we? So one thing quickly, actually two things. So there's a drainage improvement district 5, which is essentially China Ditch out in the Hawkinson area.
So you talked to John Matson.
Well, no.
I better. Yeah.
Then there's the Dyking Improvement District number 14, which is basically the area that goes west from Highway 501, like in the Frenchman's Bar area, mm-hmm. west of Vancouver Lake. So both of those have vacant positions, and the election takes place in February, and no candidates filed for those positions. So these are essentially confirmed vacancies at this point since the candidate filing period is closed. So in both cases, there's an opportunity for the Board of Commissioners to fill the vacancy, which is how the law reads for those supervisor positions. They're filled by the Board of Commissioners. For number... Yes.
Is it a paid position?
No.
Is it a full-time position, or is it
no?
Kind of
he's very much part-time. John Matson is one. I don't know who the other one is on DID 5, but for number 5, what I would recommend is you open it up so you can essentially call for applications for people who may be interested in applying for the vacancy. DID 14 is a whole different issue. The problem is, almost all the area in DID 14 is owned by institutions like Clark County, Department of Ecology, Port of Vancouver. And RCW is very clear that you can't have somebody serving as a supervisor for a Dyking Improvement District if they represent a state agency or a subdepartment of the state. So all of those are stricken off the list. It's really, because there's very little population there. It basically boils it down to the Fazio brothers who are already serving in two positions on that board. But as kind of a remnant property from 501, there's a little sliver of Anderson Dairy that owns property out there, and they do farm it. So what
about
I have...
the dudes down at the the dock, the boathouse place?
It's right next to the lake.
Right. What about them?
I think that's on the other side of the lake. This would only...
This doesn't include them?
No, because I've looked at every property from the tax lots database.
Basically, this is the only one.
So this is the person who represents Anderson Dairy, and since we're really constrained as to who potentially could be a supervisor, I asked him to see if he had a letter of interest he wanted to submit. He did, so I want to see if you're okay with just going ahead. And,
yeah.
Okay.
Here's a... another gentleman in my office yesterday, and he had something to do with Dyking. He lives, he's a resident here, and he's a Dyking something for Hayden Island.
Well, that's interesting. Huh.
And they have a lot of authority. But he must be out by the airport too, because he was talking about someone plowing in telephone cable or TV cable or something like that, and that they have some say-so over this stuff.
I think it might be more like the flood districts that they have over there to control the slough.
No, it's a Dyking district. But it's over there, so I didn't know. Someone of that knowledge, it'd be nice to...
Are Dyking districts a state construct or federal?
They're actually local, sort of like a city. They're incorporated from the local people that live there. But it is, I think this one goes all the way back to the 1800s.
They have very horrible laws.
Gotcha.
Weird laws.
Back when the Columbia River would flood regularly to protect the farmland and
got
the lowland area.
Dyking drainage and flood control districts, all three.
So these people, they serve as an advisory board?
No, they're
some supervisors.
Of these districts.
Yeah, I'm thinking.
Really?
Well, they
levy their
right over there.
Yeah. They receive their own taxes. They have, they can condemn property.
The drainage district, I mean, that's why, yeah, they get money.
Not a lot, but they do.
They
basically maintain the...
Yeah.
They want more.
Kind of like oversee it, make sure someone's not cutting into the dikes and things like that.
Okay, that was it.
I just want a question on that. So basically, the person who's going to be sitting on the board is going to be in a position to receive the funds from that district? They're kind of a company.
If they levy funds, I don't think every district levies funds, but if they do, yeah, they would be just like you guys with the county budget. They have a Dyking district budget.
Yeah, are there any funds being levied now?
I don't know.
It would have to be in existence, and it's usually charged to
property owners.
It goes on as a property tax charge to residences in the district. So for Dyking districts, if your house is protected by the dike that the district you're in, you pay property tax to pay for the pumps and all, you know, all that kind of
stuff. So it sounds like this is probably the logical way to go. I just want to make sure that we, being that they have, it's not just an advisory board. They're potentially a taxing district, mm-hmm. could receive taxes, levy taxes, and make big decisions that could be, I would think that you want to make sure that you open it up competitive, proper notice is given, and that has already happened, and we didn't get anybody.
Because it's an election. These are elected positions. Yeah, nobody applied. Positions. Nobody filed for election for this.
Well, how did the word get out?
Well, the elections office basically waits to see who's interested in filing for a position.
How would they know that the position is open?
Open elected positions.
Just pay attention.
And that's geographically qualified. You have to live there.
Yes.
And how many people live there?
Yeah.
You have to own property in the district.
And if it's a
corporation, the way I understand it is a corporate ownership can be a representative from the corporation.
So like Fazio Brothers has something.
It turns out this guy actually does work the land, so he's very familiar with it. But I don't think he's a resident.
But for the drainage district one, that's, I think, what we would be doing is exactly what you're saying. For the drainage district one, there are more than just one or two people that could do it. There's a fair number of people in the Hawkinson area that would qualify, that are part of the drainage district.
Mm-hmm.
So us getting the word, I mean, we would definitely be providing enhanced notice than what elections normally would do.
What I would suggest for the drainage position is that we would put on the grid today for our board time the application in a description that would just be one more way that people could find out about it. Make sure John Mattson knows also. Okay. Maybe he knows different people who would be interested.
What I have here is a draft press release to essentially announce the position and how to get that information out.
Great. We can include that on today's
We give that to Holly
info.
And do mm-hmm.
Holly's already given me her feedback on it.
Great.
Cool. And as I've just learned.
Oh,
so we have to live there. You have to live.
Or own property.
Yeah.
Live or own property.
Own property. Living there actually
does. Along the dike?
Within
the district.
Within the district.
Yeah.
We have to be clear what that district is.
Yeah. We have to have a map of the boundaries or something.
Roughly.
Okay. Yeah. All right.
Yeah.
Wouldn't it make sense to run an ad in the Reflector?
We could. I don't think we've done
it. It's in the district.
It's a nominal cost. Why wouldn't we do that?
Well, first of all,
question would be, the question is earned versus paid. Can we get earned media from the Reflector? Can we get a press release to the Reflector and make sure that they run something about it?
If
they did, then it's earned.
So free? They would do it
then
free?
Then it's earned media instead of us having to pay for it.
That sounds great.
You just have to have it there by something like
that.
That's
what press releases are for, just to get
So you're already going to arrange that?
Kelly and I have worked on that.
Oh, great.
Cool. Because you're right. The Reflector is much better as far as,
that area.
I would say, Hawkinson, Bowdoin, you know, that area. So.
Great.
Good news. Anything else?
That's it, sir.
Mark?
You're done? Covered my stuff.
Anything for the good of the order?
Good to go.
Nice. We have the Seahawks game on Saturday.
Woo!
Knock on.
Yep.
Got a ticket.
Thanks, everybody.
Yeah, so you're going to go to that one and not wait for championship, huh?
Yeah, that was the deal that was struck.
I make copies of this and hand it to you.
All right.
Yeah. Have fun with that.
Yeah, Blair.
Blair is also.
Yeah, I hired
where I'm going to go.
Oh.
I'm not going to go.
He used to be
you did?
The Southwest.
You got an accident, Joe, that was falling?
Oh.